City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Peter Maverick.
I'm Amy Matheny. This Queer Cast is brought to you in part by
Bud Light. Always worth it. American Airlines, offering the GLBT community exciting vacation packages online at aa.com/rainbow.
To the Windy City Queercast, show number 187. I'm Amy Matheny, and I'm just thrilled about this show today. I really, really am. So I'm really glad that you're joining me for it. First of all, really good news that the Cubs, the Chicago Cubs, won their first game in spring training, 12-6. They beat the Giants today. That just makes me sound like a dyke, so I have to give that little tidbit of information of sports analogy for you, coming from the lesbian who really can't swing a bat or throw a ball, but loved the movie A League of Their Own and loves Bull Durham. I love sports movies in general, but so anyhow, doesn't make me that much of a sporty dyke, but I do know what's going on with the Cubs and won their first game, so way to knock it out of the park. Also wanted to say that, you know, I just think it's so strange this year that I'm watching American Idol, which is one of my guilty pleasures, and I'm really shocked by how nobody's really standing out to me this year, except that it feels like a more queer year than we've ever had. Really love the cute, sweet little David who sang Imagine this week, and just really, wow, if that kid is 17 years old, imagine where he'll be at 27. Pretty shocking. And my gay boy that I love, who I guess was in the bottom three, which makes no sense, Danny Noriega. Love him. Why doesn't he pick some Patti LaBelle? He had classic 70s music. And if I were him, I would have slung down some old Patti LaBelle or some Diana Ross or Donna Summer. I just really want him to throw down with the attitude and just let it all hang out. But one of my male guilty pleasures on the show is this sweet little doughy-eyed, looks like a lesbian, or is he a gay man, or is he just the sensitive new age guy? The cute little Jason Castro, last name, even in the Castro right there, reason to love him, who has the dreads and the dreamy eyes. He looks like lesbians that I knew in the 90s who were mostly from the West Coast or had that West Coast flavor. Like, can't you just see him slipping on a pair of Birkenstocks and playing his acoustic guitar up on Knob Hill in San Francisco? The cutie, cutie Jason Castro. He's totally dreamy. He's getting all the lesbian votes. I just know he is. And obviously who got kicked off was Jason Yeager and Robbie. Robbie was the rocker wannabe, kind of Axl Rose wannabe, but none of the grit. Jason Yeager totally gone because that Jason with his little stripe in his hair, he just seemed, I don't know. I think he has a son. They didn't say anything about the wife. And I wonder if he was a single gay dad of one and he should have just come on out. And that might have at least given him a lot of the GLBT vote. But I wasn't happy with who they kicked off for the girls. Alexandria I think is how you pronounce her name. Really, really beautiful girl, beautiful singer, young and seemed to have an energy that was kind of fun and funky and really independent spirit. And I was so sad that she was kicked off, though she handled it with a lot of grace. I do not believe she was the right girl to kick off at all. And then the little 17-year-old Alana, who sang Hopelessly Devoted to You. The sad thing about this was that Alexandria sang that, "Ooh, darling, please don't go." Whose song is that? I don't even know who that is. Is that Chicago? And Alana sang Hopelessly Devoted to You. They both had to sing these extremely sad exit songs on American Idol, which has just got to be the worst. But there's already so many tears flowing this year. I mean, these kids are crying so much, and I know it's emotional, but I think these kids now have even more and more and more built up. I mean, this is the generation, right, who was raised on American Idol. If they're 17, they've been watching it for the past 7 years, so they started watching and they were 10, 9 or 10. So I don't know. It's really, really going to be interesting. Of the girls, I don't know. I don't really have a favorite yet. I love the Irish girl, but I don't know that she's an American Idol, even though she's got major Mondo chops singing vocals. And I love Amanda the Rocker Nurse, but I don't think she's going to make it all the way through to the end unless she truly gets on the money about what she's about and really starts to kind of pick better songs. I'm not sure if she has the chops when she's not really rocking out. But I thought the surprising thing, I was happy with anybody singing Linda Ronstadt in a classic rock 70s setting. Because I was trying to think, you know, I mean, maybe you were too, like, what 70s classic rock song would I want to sing? Well, Linda Ronstadt would definitely have been one of my choice. And Christy Cook, the cowgirl. Boy, is she a tomboy or what? Fresh-faced, Carrie Russell-looking thing, astride a horse and baling hay and playing ball and can't walk in heels. Tall and leggy like a filly. Just a beautiful girl. And she came out guns a-blazing with some Linda Ronstadt. Really showed off her voice. So that was some fun. So also had the season finale of Nip Tuck. Yes, I'm talking about television a little bit in this show because I haven't talked about it in a while. Nip Tuck was just way wackadoo this year. Sorry excuse for the use of lesbianism, if you ask me, with Portia de Rossi. I can't believe that throughout the entire season, we really had very little hot sex from her and Miss Richardson, which Richardson Revgrave, which just kind of stinks. And I don't know. I was just so disturbed by it. But I do have to say, very fun, convincing, and creepy turn by the woman that we pull into our lesbian fold. Ooh, that sounded so disgusting. I wouldn't say that again. The woman who we just believe is one of ours, even though we know she's not, and she's not gay, but she's always been such a great ally, and that's Sharon Gless. What a creepy, absolutely can't take your eyes off the television performance did Sharon Gless give this season on Nip Tuck as just the most sinister, demented, quirky and sick sycophant fan on the show. Just really, I thought she was so good. And with that and with Burn Notice, Sharon Gless is really making a comeback. And I know on my TiVo, we have a lot of Cagney and Lacey reruns that continually are saved because, oh my God, were they the best or what? Tyne Daly and Sharon Gless. My girlfriend's totally addicted. And I've met both of them. I've actually had dinner with Sharon Gless and Tyne Daly. Little tidbit, in case you've never heard me tell that story before. If you have, I'm oh so sorry. But it was really a phenomenal night because I was in Andersonville, which is the lesbian neighborhood kind of here in Chicago. I was at a lesbian-owned restaurant having dinner with Cagney and Lacey, with Sharon Gless and Tyne Daly. And I have to tell you, lesbian eyes were bugging out and jaws were dropping. And it was so funny because we were sitting in the window and there were just four of us having dinner. And oh my God, those two women are really good friends and extremely funny and just super, super, super cool women, both of them. So, you know, I am glad because Tyne has had such of our so much of the GLBT affections with her many, many, many roles on Broadway, especially Gypsy. I thought she was absolutely the most fantastic Gypsy. Do you get your newspaper every Sunday where they have the little insert, the Parade magazine or whatever it's called? And they were doing a survey on who was the best ever Mama Rose. And because she was on our show last week, I would have to say Alexandra Billings knocked it out of the park and was the best. But if I have to say from people that everybody knows, like who was the best on Broadway at Gypsy or Mama Rose and Gypsy, Tyne Daly to me was the best Mama Rose. Hands down. I didn't see Pay LaPone. I've seen her performances. I can imagine what she'd do with it. Bernadette Peters, fine and dandy. Angela Lansbury, fine and dandy. Ethel Merman, of course, set the bar. But Tyne Daly seriously gave the performance of a career, gave the performance of a decade of leading lady diva, the Hamlet, as I would call it, the Hamlet of musical theater roles for women. When she played Mama Rose. So I don't know if you can still vote, but if you go to parade.com, that's where I voted, and I voted for Tyne Daly. So anyhow, speaking of people who've had amazing careers and diva-like experiences, our next guest on the show today is a woman named Jennifer Storm. And she's not a diva, and yet her life would have to be played by an actress of the highest ability to show extreme life experiences. What I mean by that is you cannot imagine how dramatic Jennifer Storm's life was, even up to the age of 15, how extraordinary and extraordinarily hard and challenged her life was by the disease of addiction. Jennifer has a new book out called Blackout Girl, Growing Up and Drying Out in America. And I really highly recommend this book. First of all, if you know anyone or somebody you know is struggling with alcoholism or drug abuse. And also because I think it is a story that is not told these days. I think that there is something that when we talk about gays and lesbians and addiction, or the gay community and addiction, we immediately talk about men, and generally the topic steers to circuit party drugs or crystal meth. I've done so many interviews on trying to talk to the men's community about circuit parties, the pros and cons of circuit parties when their benefits and the actual drug use that's going on, but rarely do I don't think I've ever done an interview with a lesbian on any addiction type topic. And I think that's fascinating. You know, here in Chicago, they have, with the Lesbian Community Cancer Project, now a part of Howard Brown, they have a group called Bitch to Quit. And it's obviously a stop smoking group. And we did a story about a month ago about how much higher lesbians smoke than heterosexual women and how much more they are prone to depression. And I believe that that kind of addictive personality, that looking for something to fill some sort of void or numb out, is a very common thing with gay women. And I think also the disease of alcoholism and addiction is just extremely prevalent in our community. And but yet it's a story that's not told. And why is that? Why are our stories as lesbians brushed under the rug, so to speak? Well, Jennifer Storm did the brave thing. She wrote the story, talks about her life from a very young age to currently now, where she's in a job today that is fascinating, working with violent crimes, and really is somebody who is giving back and trying to protect and give voice to other people who are victims of other circumstances in their life. The book has been published by Hazelden, which is a publishing group that publishes a lot of 12-step and alcohol and drug abuse addiction literature. So it really has the stamp of the professionals and the, one of the major publishing houses in the world on this topic. And yet the story is so personable that you feel like you really get to know Jennifer, you get to know her story. And she just tells it in such a clear way, just what her experiences were, that it is extremely moving. Plus, the back of the book has lots of resources. So I think this is going to be a very significant interview, especially if you are struggling with how much you're drinking, especially if you are struggling with how much you're taking some kind of drug or narcotic, either a prescription drug, which I know can maybe seem acceptable, and then one day you turn on the light to yourself and realizing that what used to be a simple solution has now become a very complex problem, or whether you are dealing with depression or the fear of truly expressing who you are as a gay or lesbian person, or you have been the victim of sexual abuse. I mean, there is so much in this story. I think many of you will relate. And also, it may remind you of somebody that you are worried about in your life or have concerns for. Plus, Jennifer's just a really great gal, so I really appreciate her sitting and talking with me and sharing this story, not only with us on the podcast, but also with us in print. The book is out now, so you can get it. Plus, there's a lot of news going on and so much theater. I've been in the theater quite a bit in the past weeks and seeing some really good stuff here in Chicago and more stuff on the horizon as we head into spring. So stay tuned and sit back, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Edible Underwear Maker.
Mr. Edible Underwear Maker.
Your true genius combined two of man's favorite things, panties and food.
I can taste it now.
They're a snack. They're underwear. They're a snack and underwear. Brilliant.
Two treats in one.
Gorgeous grape. Rock my world raspberry. Bodacious banana.
26 flavors.
And nothing says I want you like a man with a mouthful of underpants.
I want you, baby.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, Mr. Edible Underwear Maker. Because thanks to you, when it comes to panties, extra large means extra yummy.
Yummy.
Beer at Isabu, St. Louis, Missouri.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of February 25th, 2008, you are in Chicago's Culture Club.
Court Theater reimagines one of the greatest musicals of all time, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel, now playing through April 13th. When carnival barker Billy Bigelow meets mill worker Julie Jordan, fate sends them both on a journey that spans heaven and earth as they explore the limits of love, human frailty, and redemption. For tickets, visit courttheater.org.
Giordano Jazz Dance Chicago explodes on the Harris Stage March 7th and 8th with the world premiere of Moanin' Low by former Joffrey dancer Davis Robertson and company hits such as Pyrokinesis, Prey, and The Man That Got Away. The Tribune says their explosive techniques has fans gasping. For one weekend only, experience the power, passion, and vitality of Giordano Jazz Dance Chicago. Call today, 312-334-7777 or visit harristheaterchicago.org.
Writers Theater presents As You Like It by William Shakespeare, directed by William Brown. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. A courtship with a twist, men in exile, a melancholy wit, a clown, a lovesick shepherd, and the shepherdess who spurns him all swirl together in a wildly beautiful romp through the magical forest of Arden. Some of the most romantic and charming scenes ever in this most perfect of comedies. For more about As You Like It at Writers Theater, log on to writerstheater.org or call 847 247 242-6000.
The Tony Award-winning musical comedy favorite La Caja Folle is playing now at Theater at the Center, conveniently located in nearby Munster, Indiana. The New York Post says this is Jerry Herman's best musical yet. Happier, more assertive, more buoyant than Hello Dolly or MAME. Don't miss La Caja Folle. Call now, 219-836-3255, or visit theateratthecenter.com.
Writers Theater presents The Turn of the Screw from the story by Henry James. Time Out Chicago calls it surprisingly and creepily suggestive. An unsuspecting governess is hired to look after two seemingly innocent children who soon reveal terrifying secrets. The Sun-Times raves, eerie as ever, Screw will mesmerize you. For tickets to The Turn of the Screw, go to writerstheater.org or call 847-242-6000.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Every night at the LaSalle Bank Theater, the curtain goes up on Jersey Boys, and something amazing happens. The music plays and the story unfolds as the show flies by. Four blue-collar kids turn into pop superstars, and 2,000 ticket holders turn into Jersey Boys fanatics.
I love you, baby, and if it's quite all right,
ask anyone who's seen it, like critic Chris Jones in the Tribune, who calls Jersey Boys the most exciting new musical in years. Or Hetty Weiss in the Sun-Times, who says this show is pure platinum, a supercharged knockout. Don't wait another minute to get your tickets. Jersey Boys, see it now. Just call 312-902-1400 or visit BroadwayInChicago.com today.
And this is your Windy City Careercast News. A commission said that New Jersey's civil union law is flawed and creates a second-class status for same-sex couples. The commission's report highlighted the law's problems, but did not make any recommendations. However, they did state that poorer couples, transgender people, and those in the military have an even harder time with the law.
Plans to move a same-sex marriage ban forward in Indiana is most likely dead in the water until 2012. State Representative Scott Pelleth helped kill the amendment by choosing not to hear the legislation. Indiana law requires that amendments be passed by two consecutive legislatures before they are placed on a general election ballot for voters to decide. Pelleth said the amendment is poorly worded and unnecessary as the state already bans gay marriage. Proponents of the amendment are trying to pressure the House Speaker to allow a vote.
A legislator's attempt to ban discussion of homosexuality in Tennessee schools died in a House subcommittee. State Representative Stacy Campfield wanted all discussion of homosexuality banned from the state's elementary and middle schools. It was dropped because the subcommittee thought the measure was unnecessary.
China's Ministry of Health launched its first HIV prevention program for gay men. The rates of infection have increased over the past few years. China has been making strides, but slowly. In 1997, the country decriminalized sodomy.
A Harris Interactive study found that one-third of gays and lesbians would switch their car insurance to a gay-friendly company. 33% of gay and lesbian participants said they would make the swap if they knew the company offered domestic partner benefits to its employees. And twice as many gay and lesbians seeking auto insurance purchase their policy online than their heterosexual counterparts.
The Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, GLAAD, expressed disappointment in how the New York Daily News reported on the recent murder of a transgender woman. The article included the word tranny, described the victim as, quote, a man who dressed like a woman, end quote, used male pronouns throughout, and insinuated that the victim, a prostitute, had fooled her attacker. The 25-year-old transgender prostitute was stabbed to death in her Bronx apartment, allegedly by a 37-year-old male customer.
British actor Rupert Everett isn't a fan of gay pride events. The openly gay actor said, I think all these pride marches have lost their center slightly. He said that the events are not political anymore and are attended by party-grazing cows.
The new romantic comedy, Definitely, Maybe, featuring Rachel Weisz, Elizabeth Banks, and Ryan Reynolds, includes a lesbian subplot. Reynolds' character tries to choose between three women. His current wife, played by Banks, once had an affair with the woman, played by Rachel Weisz.
And Renee O'Connor, Gabrielle on the former TV show Xena Warrior Princess, guest stars in the upcoming season of the Lifetime drama Army Wives. Catherine Fugate, Army Wives creator and former Xena writer, confirmed that Renee appears in a 5-6 episode arc in, quote, a position you wish you'd seen her on in Xena, end quote. She also confirmed her character will be a sensual, the aggressor. Army Wives' new episodes appear this summer. We'll be watching for that. And that's your Windy City Careercast News.
Hi, this is Sandra Bernhard, and you're listening to me on Windy City Queer Cast. Cast your net wide, and who knows what you'll come up with.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change? How bad, how good does it need to get? How many losses, how much regret?
Blackout Girl, Growing Up and Drying Out in America is a new memoir from Jennifer Storm that chronicles her struggle with alcohol and drugs from a very young age, her suppression and shame with her homosexuality, and her eventual life-changing transformation, because today she is the executive director of the Victim Witness Assistance Program in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And it's been a long journey, and we're glad to have Jennifer here with us to talk about it. Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're thrilled to talk with you. I have to tell you, this book is quite engaging. You will flip through it. So, I mean, it's a fast read just because it's a very exciting life. And all you have to do is tell that story, because it's a lot that has gone on in your short amount of your life. Talk to me about what your life looked like 15 years ago before you got clean.
Oh God. Yeah, it was a mess. And, I was very lost is probably the best way to describe it. You know, I knew very early on that I was gay. I joke that I knew in kindergarten, my first crush was in kindergarten. I can tell you the girl's name. And you know, so those feelings were always very natural for me. They were always very, you know, they just made sense to me. And it wasn't until I started getting kind of various messages, societal messages telling me that this was wrong, that I kind of started to suppress that. And I always kind of knew that I didn't fit in. Like, I always had this desire to escape, but I can't pinpoint why. And I did kind of toy around a little bit with alcohol when I was really young, but it wasn't until I was 12 that I actually had my first drink. And I had gone out with a friend who I trusted at the time, who was older than me. She was 16. And that evening, you know, like I said, I had my first drink, and I had several drinks, and so many that I blacked out. Mm-hmm. And when I came to, I was being sexually assaulted. And so that was really a huge turning point for me in my life. And it, that coupled with the, you know, the confusion that I had about my sexuality and this already kind of existent need to escape, which I'm pretty sure was tied to the sexuality stuff, I just started drinking. And drinking quickly turned into smoking pot, which turned in quickly to dropping acid, which led to using cocaine, which eventually led to smoking crack cocaine. And I was definitely a binge drinker, hands down. Like, I never picked up a drink without getting completely hammered every time. And when I started doing cocaine, I kind of realized that it enabled my drinking. You know, I would get really, really drunk to that point where I would almost black out. And I learned that if I did cocaine, it kind of sobered me up and it enabled me to party longer. Because it was always about the alcohol for me. And so, you know, obviously when you're living that kind of life and when you're in that kind of environment, when you're constantly just intoxicated, more things happen to you that are negative. And so I definitely faced more victimization. After the first sexual assault, we did prosecute, and I went to, I had to go to court. It was found out that the guy was 28 years old, so he was charged and convicted. But I had some other encounters, and every sexual encounter I ever had was during intoxication, so my confusion just grew and grew in terms of that issue. And it was almost that one fueled the other constantly.
When you talk about not feeling like from a very young age you fit in, you know, this is a common theme that we hear a lot with GLBT people. It's also for anyone who knows anyone in addiction or recovery or battling alcoholism is also the thing you constantly hear an addict say, I didn't fit in. Talk about just kind of, you know, you had a lot of addiction and a lot of alcoholism in your family. Do you feel like in the same way people had the nature nurture with sexuality, is there a nature nurture with addiction, do you feel?
I definitely feel like I was predisposed to the disease, you know, because there were so many individuals in my family who were drug addicted and alcoholic, including my mom, my grandmother. So I definitely think that I was kind of predisposed. And I do think that it's, you know, it's a disease that you're born with, but you can also, I think, inherit it, if you will. So, you know, I think I was born alcoholic, which I think kind of explains that need to escape and that need to desire to just kind of remove myself. And I found comfort in alcohol. Like, that became the kind of the solution to my problems, if you will. I never saw alcohol or the drug use as the source of my problems. For me, it was always, you know, that was how I dealt with things, you know, and already kind of feeling socially awkward and not totally comfortable in my own skin. I mean, alcohol is the best social lubricant there is, right? I mean, it helps you feel comfortable. It helps you kind of walk into a room and become what others you think others expect you to be. And so I was trying to live this heterosexual life, even though deep down I knew I was so uncomfortable in it. It was so much easier to do it totally drunk.
Yeah.
You know?
So talk to me about Kristen. I mean, this was one of, you write about Kristen and one of your earliest notions of when you kind of went, okay, this is beyond the girl that you had the crush on in kindergarten, when actually it became something real to you. And also what happened in response to that relationship that then affected you for the next years of your life until the tattoo, as we said.
Until the tattoo, yes. Well, you know, I had this best friend. Her name was Kristen, and or at least her name in the book was Kristen. Mm-hmm. And you know, we hung out all the time, and I, you know, I knew that I had feelings for her. And sadly enough, this was right around, it was in, you know, when Dirty Dancing came out, and the movie was huge, and so we would watch it constantly. And you know, she and I would talk about, you know, what it was like, what it would be like to kiss boys, and if we liked boys. And, you know, I never really felt like I did, but I would say things just to go along with her. But at the same time, she and I were totally engaging in this kind of relationship that was beyond friendship. I mean, we would give each other back rubs with no shirts on. You know, we were flirty with one another, but we were young, so it was innocent. And one night we decided to kind of emulate the dancers in Dirty Dancing, and we were doing that in her bedroom. And, you know, obviously they're you're grinding up against one another, and it's the whole Dirty Dancing. And her father, who was really, really religious, like very, you know, born again Christian, came into the room and found us doing this and just freaked and started screaming Leslie at me and saying I was going to hell, and, you know, was basically chasing me out of his house while screaming biblical passages at me. So that really, it was very confusing. I didn't know what a lesbian was. I'd never heard that term. You know, I didn't know why all of a sudden I was doomed to hell, you know, and it was such an incredible experience, because part of me was so exhilarated by, you know, kind of the feeling that I got from being this close with another girl. And at the same time, I was having this really negative experience. And so I had a really hard time negotiating through that. And I never really knew if, you know, I didn't know gay people existed. You know, my parents didn't raise me to believe that gay people even existed, let alone to tell me that, okay, this is right or it's wrong. So I was really confused, and I didn't feel like I could talk with my parents, because we didn't have a household where talking about anything was appropriate. Like, you know, after I was sexually assaulted, we just, you know, my family didn't talk about it. They were just in this denial, and I think they were so incredibly uncomfortable about it themselves that, you know, we just didn't have a household that fostered that kind of communication. So, you know, I was confused. And so she and I, you know, kind of managed to get through it. And we talked about it. And I joke about this in the book that we, you know, we went to Teen Beat, which at that time was like, you know, the magazine of our age. And, you know, I remember us reading an article that said, you know, well, all adolescent girls go through this phase where you have a crush on your best friend. And it's totally normal and it'll go away and it's just a phase. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we read that and thought, okay, great. You know, this is just a phase. And for her, it was. For me, I knew deep down it totally wasn't. But you know, that, you know, we started getting taunted and teased in our neighborhood, because, you know, the story kind of got out, and, you know, boys are cruel at that age. So I knew quickly that I did not want to be whatever this Leslie thing was, whatever that was. I didn't want to be that, because it didn't feel good. You know, it was painful. And so I just did the absolute opposite. I joked that I became like a flaming heterosexual, you know, and it was so much easier to do that drunk.
Yeah.
Well, you know, 'cause then I didn't really have to deal with what I was doing. And my, you know, my issues with sexuality were just, you know, my understanding of sex was so messed up. And my first sexual experience was a rape. So, you know, I had all that tied into the knowledge that I really wasn't wanting to do this with guys anyway. So I would just really kind of detach during any kind of sexual encounters and just really, you know, try to not be present, if you will.
So the subtitle of the book is Growing Up and Drying Out in America. What was it for you that made you grow up and dry out? Because you've got these issues of addiction, you've got all kinds of issues of sexuality going on, and on top of that, you know, you're young, so we all have crazy heads when we're young just to begin with. I mean, before anything else happens in there, we have these swirling of hormones and emotions and things like that. So what was it that forced you to start growing up and drying out?
It was my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer when we were younger, and had a mastectomy, and they had kind of assured us that everything was fine, and it came back later, and I was around 21 years old, and when it came back real bad, and it was evident that she was not gonna make it, and she did eventually succumb to that, and she died from that, and after that, you know, a lot of my using was to kind of cover up my feelings. And I got drunk and I got high to not feel, to not be present, to just completely numb myself. And when that happened, it was almost like I couldn't get enough drugs and alcohol into my system to numb the immense pain that provided for me. And it kind of all came to a head one night. And I was alone in my apartment. And at this point, I was working at a bar and I was living above the bar in this skanky hotel. Or it was more of an apartment, but and I just decided, you know what, I can't live like this anymore. And I was so hopeless and full of so much despair that I didn't think I could live. I didn't think I could change. So I decided to try to kill myself. In the middle of about 24 to 36 hour binge, I decided to take my own life, and thank God it didn't work.
And it wasn't the first time that you'd tried to do that. I mean,
suicidal ideations had been definitely a part of my history.
Yeah.
And I had a friend who killed herself when we were 15 years old. She was one of my best friends, and that had a huge impact on me. I would say that my attempt, because I had one kind of official suicide attempt, if you will, when I was 13, and that was more probably me screaming out for help, whereas this last one was really like, okay, yeah, I'm done. You know, I really just didn't see a way out. There was no foreseeable way out for me. You know, and like I said, thank God I didn't. You know, something save me, if you will, because by all rights, I should be dead. The degree that I went to try to kill myself was pretty severe. And so, you know, after I woke up and I was alive, which was a shock, I thought, okay, you know, I obviously, you know, I don't want to live this way anymore. And this, you know, suicide solution didn't work. So obviously there's got to be something better for me. And I just had this hope that I had never had before. And I don't know where that came from. And it's remained with me, you know, and it's been, you know, over 10 years now.
So talk to me about what your life does look like today. Obviously, you've been on a path of recovery for 10 years and sober for that long. And you're an upstanding citizen in the world.
I'm not a crack whore anymore.
Exactly. And you have reconciled as a lesbian. So talk to me about what that looks like. I mean, what is on the other side of that? I give up, I'm done. Yeah. And yet there's a kernel of hope that has been transformative to you.
Yeah. I mean, today my life is just wonderful. It's beyond my wildest dreams. I'm present for it. I remember it, which is nice. and I'm fully open. I'm totally, you know, I've always, when I made the decision to get sober, a lot of that for me was about, okay, it's time to be 100% honest about everything. And a lot of the process of recovery is about being totally honest with yourself and everyone around you. And so obviously a big part of that was, you know, okay, it's time to come out of the closet. And, you know, I joke that I didn't come some kind of like quiet understanding of my sexuality. I came like flying out of the closet and straight into doing a ton of activism in the community. And so my life today is just living very honestly, and I'm very happy. I love the work that I do. I love the life that I lead. And I don't have to turn to drugs and alcohol to make myself feel comfortable or to avoid dealing with things, because I now know how to deal with my emotions, and I have no desire to alter my state of being. So, you know, I don't need social lube anymore, which is nice.
Yeah, absolutely. So being on the confidence side of that, why a book? Why was it important for you to write a book about this?
Yeah. Writing has always been a really important part of my life ever since I was little. And it's funny, I actually have saved all of my old poetry and journals and little books that I would have written. So it's always been a big part of my life. And so when I got sober, you know, obviously I do a lot of writing in sobriety because a lot of it is about, you know, taking personal inventory of your past and really looking at, you know, where you've been and what you've done. And so by doing that, I just started this kind of massive journal. And it built upon itself and built upon itself. And it was, you know, kind of me telling my story. And I got to the point where it was like, okay, you know, I kind of have something here. And I knew that I had a story that I wanted to tell, you know, after telling it verbally several times in the program, I knew that it was, you know, I had something here that I wanted to share. And I think the other part was that being a young female, a young gay female also, in coming into recovery, there were very little resources for me. I love to write, but I also love to read. And I learn a lot and I process a lot through reading. And there weren't a lot of books out there that told my story. You know, because there were some that, you know, just talked about alcoholism or, you know, surviving sexual abuse. But unfortunately, I had been through so much. And there wasn't a book out there that spoke to me. And so I thought, I know I'm not alone because I've met now hundreds of other women through rehab and in the program and traveling that I know I'm not unique. So, you know, maybe it would be positive to share my story with somebody else.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that addiction, when we think of addiction in the gay community, we immediately think of gay men, we immediately think
gay
of crystal
men.
Meth. Gay white
gay
men
white
and crystal
men
meth.
Crystal meth.
And you know,
exactly.
We don't hear the lesbian stories of addiction, and we know that alcoholism is such a key agent in just really
a
big battle in so many lesbian lives. Why do you think that they're not told?
You know, I'm not sure. When I was doing some research for this book, I found a statistic that was said 30% of all lesbians have a drinking problem. And I thought, God, that's high.
Yeah.
And then I thought about, you know, all my friends and all the people that I've known. I thought, but it's real. You know, because I do. I know a lot of lesbians who are alcoholic, who wouldn't admit it. And I think there's a lot of reasons. I think that, in any community, alcoholism is very prevalent, but it's very hidden and it's not talked about because it is so socially acceptable. Mm. You know, happy hour is ingrained in our lives, in our society. It is, you know, for the most part, pretty acceptable to go out on a Friday, any given Friday and Saturday night and get slightly hammered, if not overboard hammered. Mm. And, you know, we make excuses for that. So I think that it's just this level of acceptance in our society in general that keeps people from really coming forward. And it isn't until people really push the envelope and get really extreme in their addiction that someone might say, okay, you know what, you have a problem, you might need to get help. Or that actual person will say, all right, it's gotten bad enough that I need to get help.
Right. So you specialize in victims and people, mm-hmm. you know, who are victims of crimes. I know you've done a lot in your activism with hate crime legislation. And but I want to talk to you just because of your diverse background about what's been going on in the news. I mean, I think it's been going on for a while, but obviously we've had two recent kind of Hollywood deaths with Brad Renfro and Heath Ledger. We've been fascinated in the drinking and drugging and unmanageable, crazy lives of Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie and Lindsay Lohan, who now seems to be back on the up and up, and Amy Winehouse and of course Britney.
Say it, Britney.
Yeah. Do we need to say anything else? I mean, what is happening today? Is this new? Is this always been around, but now we're just shining the light on it? And do you think they're all victims? Are they all crying out for help, or what do you see this as?
I don't know how new it is. I think that definitely there's a whole new kind of light being shined on celebrity in general. I mean, the paparazzi is out of control. So we are seeing so much more of these individuals' lives on a daily basis. I mean, I've seen Britney Spears get a latte more times than I've seen, like, the 7 o'clock news. You know what I mean? It's almost ludicrous. It really is.
It's true.
It's like, who cares? And I think about it, you know, God, if there had been a camera following me around, oh, my God. I couldn't even imagine that. You know, we definitely are in this time where reality TV is at an all-time high, and the interest of these individuals' lives is so peaked right now. So I think that there's two things going on. I think that there's, you know, these kids are coming up fast, they're coming up quick, they have way too many resources, and they are being covered constantly. So all of that is a kind of a mixture for disaster. I also think, though, that we still in society, specifically in media, are not looking at the problem. You know, we're still just fascinated with it. And, you know, we're still going to lean towards calling things accidental as opposed to having a real dialogue about, you know, maybe there's an actual addiction problem here and an opportunity to learn. I thought it was absolutely ludicrous that President Bush delayed his speech and his campaign on prescription drug use and the harms of it to honor Heath Ledger's death. Like, it didn't make any sense to me. I thought, if anything, isn't this the most incredible opportunity
right.
to open the eyes of America
right.
to the problem that you're trying to create awareness of? But
yeah,
again,
yeah,
he is an effing moron. So he's not going to do
well,
anything
yeah.
appropriate. you know, it's like, come on. We don't want to talk about it. You know, it's we're getting there. I mean, it's getting a little bit better. Like, HBO did that incredible series on addiction, which I thought was really good. We have that show Intervention. Dr. Drew was doing that real kind of controversial show about rehab and detox. And all that.
I just saw
sure
that
I,
the other night.
I
was,
that, but,
yeah, I thought yeah. that was so fascinating. As I you know, of what is it, the bald one that's having problems of not wanting the cameras there. It's like the only time he doesn't want the cameras there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because you know he's doing something wrong.
Yeah, and one of the girls is like, you know, I'd feel odd if there weren't cameras here. Like, this is a part of my life, and they don't
yeah.
bother
Good
me.
Lord.
And Baldwin's just like wanting off the compound. Like, he's like itchy.
Yeah.
He's like, get me out of here.
Yeah, he's interesting. Because I don't know if you saw, he had like a Dateline special all about his recovery, and then, you know, he was supposedly sober, and then he found that girl, and then now he's on this show, and it's, I don't know, it's very odd.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he's just using it for fame or not. But I think some of these, you know, some of them have really clearly have an issue. Like, I think Lindsay Lohan clearly has an issue. She clearly has a substance abuse problem. Amy Winehouse, I mean, is there anything more ironic than that girl? I mean, with her song and then now.
And her name.
Yeah,
her name.
She like walks around with a crack pipe and then sings a song about not wanting to go to rehab. And now she's in rehab. But I think that hopefully will serve as a learning opportunity for other people that, like, you know, don't try to emulate these people, because, you know, even though they might joke about it and write songs about how, you know, they don't need rehab because they're so much better than that, you know, the truth is that they're not. And look at her now.
Yeah. And it's
know?
The irony of the song. I think the song's all the more powerful in just that kind of petulant way of singing, you know. So tell me, this book is being published and distributed by Hazelden Foundation.
Yes.
What is the Hazelden Foundation, and why is it great that they are putting your book out?
Sure. Hazelden's probably one of the oldest rehabilitation centers in the country, and they are also the producer of the majority of the, you know, recovery-type texts. And they don't do a ton of memoirs, so it was really exciting for me that they wanted to publish this. They've done a couple, but they specialize kind of more in treatment-oriented materials and textbooks and things like that. And when they kind of contacted me and said that I had sent them my manuscript, and when they contacted me, it was really special for me because it just felt like the absolute perfect place for my work. You know, because of the way that they are kind of ethically and morally grounded, they, you know, they get it. They are a recovery-based institution. I had some kind of worries about going with a real big mainstream publisher just because I wasn't sure how they would treat the material, and also I wasn't sure how they would be with the gay material. I mean, I got more rejections, obviously, than I got acceptance, but Hazelden just felt right. You know, I knew that I would be able to trust them with my work.
Well, I definitely think everybody, it's a great read. It's, I mean, could be made, this would be a great movie, your life. I mean, it reads like the biggest drama you've ever seen. You're kind of like, when is she going to find the light? Like, when is she going to slam down to the bottom?
And maybe Lindsay Lohan could play me, right?
I think that would be great. And then Amy Winehouse could score the whole movie. We're figuring it all out here, right? Right
there
as we go.
Yeah.
Blackout Girl, Growing Up and Drying Out in America by Jennifer Storm is available now online. You can get it at Amazon, or you can also get it at any of your, you know, go to your gay and lesbian booksellers if you have one close by.
Support
if you don't.
Indies.
If you don't, just go to a local bookstore, or also check out, and you can get it at her website, jenniferstorm.com. And there's information there where you can stay in touch with Jennifer. And are you going to be out with the book and doing some traveling?
Yes. Yeah, we are just now kind of lining up some dates. I'm going to be in Rehoboth in March, and I'm going to be at the University of Connecticut, I think in April, and then out in California in May. So, yeah, I'm definitely booking right now, booking into fall. So if there's anyone out there who has a school or a university or a queer group or anything that they're looking to have a speaker or a book reading, let me know.
Excellent.
Definitely, I'd love to come out and share the message.
It's a great, great book. Jennifer Storm, thanks so much for being on with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. This show is brought to you in part by Bud Light. Bud Light, always worth it.
And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
And Broadway in Chicago, for the hottest tickets in town, visit broadwayinchicago.com.
So that's our show. I'm Amy Matheny.
And I'm Peter Maverick. Please comment on our shows on our website and in iTunes.
The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it.
Windy City Queercast, queer and now.
Unbearable, would you change? Would you change?